The headlines: Afghan officials say government forces have repelled an attack by Taliban militants on a major border crossing with Pakistan. An explosion targeting a bus in northern Pakistan kills at least 13 people, including 9 Chinese nationals. And the UN announces the formation of a panel to investigate systemic racism in policing, with the U.S. being at the center of the probe. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Taliban say they've captured an important trade route linking Pakistan with southern Afghanistan. A Taliban spokesman says a border town of Wesh and a road linking the two countries' customs in Kandahar province is now under the control of the militants. This is while the Afghan government says its forces have repelled the Taliban attack on the transit point. Taliban militants have already captured 3 other crossings along Afghanistan's borders. They've increased their attacks on cities and villages since May, seizing dozens of rural districts. Kabul correspondent Amin Alami says a fight between the Taliban and the Afghan forces in the border region of Kandahar province has inflicted heavy losses on the militants.
Afghan local sources in Kandahar say that as a result of counterattack operation conducted by Afghan special forces, mainly Afghan border troops, over 50 Taliban militants have been killed, including foreign nationals. But in the meantime, the Taliban says that they are struggling to bring more areas under their own control. The locals and villagers there say that fightings are underway in some parts of Ispin Buldak in southern Kandahar province of Afghanistan, and in some cases civilians have lost their lives.
An explosion targeting a bus in northern Pakistan has left over a dozen people dead and many others injured. A Pakistani official said the bus was carrying Chinese engineers, surveyors, and a mechanical staff to the site of an under-construction dam in Upper Kuhistan. He said 9 Chinese nationals were among the dead and a further 28 others were injured. Security officials are investigating the cause of the blast. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. The Dasu Hydroelectric Dam project is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor that is aimed at connecting western China to Gwadar seaport in southern Pakistan. The United Nations is set to establish a panel of experts to investigate systemic racism and policing amid widespread discrimination against people of African descent, especially in the U.S. The panel of 3 experts in law enforcement and human rights will have a 3-year mandate to probe the root causes and effects of racism. And we'll look at issues ranging from excessive use of force, racial profiling, and police handling of peaceful protests. The panel will investigate law enforcement across the world, but the United States will be the focus of its work, with the murder case of George Floyd in 2020 as its reference. For years, the U.S. has been the scene of police killings of African Americans. The discovery of more unmarked graves in former church-run residential schools has opened old wounds for indigenous people in Canada. It has also become a headache for the government and the Catholic Church. During our news review program, we discuss this developing story. Let's take a look.
Hello, everybody, and a pleasure to have you here joining us in the News Review program. And now, more than 160 unmarked graves have been found at a site of another former Catholic residential school for Canada's Native children. The Penalakut tribe said the graves were found in southern Gulf Islands in the state of British Columbia. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau offered his sympathy to the tribe, pledging continued work to fight discrimination and systemic racism. But Native communities say the discovery is just the tip of the iceberg and that dozens of other unmarked graves have yet to be found. Now, more than 1,000 unmarked graves containing the remains of Indigenous children have been unearthed in Canada over the past month. Discoveries have sparked outrage against the country's former residential school system, which has already been declared as a form of cultural genocide. And now joining us for the news review program is Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Mr. Corrigan. Pleasure to have you on the news review program once again. Here we are again. I think this is the second or third time that there's been a discovery, and I've spoken to the two of you. Edward, your thoughts on the latest findings?
Well, this has certainly grabbed the attention of the people of Canada and the politicians and actually much of the world, where at four separate residential schools, they've uncovered 1,308 unmarked graves. Now, this is not really a new discovery. Back in 1974, 72 graves were found at a Battle Work Industrial School, and as well as there was 15 graves that were uncovered when there's a construction project in another school, and actually 35 graves were found in another one. This is back in the 70s and early 90s. So now we have, you know, four schools, over 1,300 unmarked graves, and, you know, this is terrible. And it's as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission determined that, you know, Canada had waged a form of cultural genocide against the Native population, and that this is terrible. And we destroyed the Natives, their own culture, their society, the institutions that they had built on, and we gave them, you know, alcohol, drugs, and sniffing gasoline. And, you know, there's a policy which they admitted that was, you know, aggressive assimilation, and they had war to kill the Indian and the child. So this was, you know, a terrible policy with their people were jammed into tight spaces. If one person had a disease, it spread quickly to the other students. And we have, you know, there was suicide, there was attempted escapes, sexual abuse. And, you know, this is now really coming up and has grabbed the attention of the Canadian public and also the world.
Thank you, Edward. And Robert Fantina, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Robert, I want to hear your initial thoughts on this, but I also want you to delve into, you know, Edward touched upon it, why the Catholic Church isn't really, you know, showing some accountability and basically more compassion and more apologetic toward what took place. And another thing that Edward touched upon, even today, as a form of reparation, the Canadian government could actually, you know, help the Indigenous, build more infrastructure to help Indigenous people better their living standards, give them more hope, give them a better future, and it's not doing that in a lot of people's eyes. And then we're finding these mass graves throughout all of this. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Justin Trudeau has expressed sympathy and sorrow and so on for the victims and the Indigenous people in general. This is all well and good, but it's completely hypocritical because he is always encouraging and supporting pipelines that are going across Native lands, destroying sacred burial grounds, destroying the land that the people own. If profits are behind it and it will benefit the corporations of Canada, Trudeau is all for it, regardless of what the Indigenous people want or need or are guaranteed by law to have. Now, your next question or comment about the Catholic Church, we shouldn't be surprised that the Catholic Church has not taken accountability for this. When we look at the clergy sex abuse scandal that rocked the entire world a few years ago and how long it was before the Catholic Church would make any statement opposing the or condemning the actions of many, many parish priests, many of whom were later promoted to bishops and cardinals, some of whom resigned. But it took an awful long time for the Catholic Church to take any responsibility for that, to show any accountability. They certainly have not to this day fully embraced the accountability they should for that. So the fact that they have not yet made any significant statement about these horrific things that happened to these innocent Indigenous people, children, is not surprising, because that's a pattern that the Catholic Church has had for years. So what needs to be done is the Canadian government needs to look at the site, at every site wherever a Native school was, and do a thorough check to see if there are graves there, and then begin the process of reconciliation, which should have been ongoing. It shouldn't begin then. It should be ongoing. As you said, providing clean water for the people who were here far, long, long before, their ancestors, long, long before Europeans ever landed on our shores. And now they're deprived of even clean water. They need to, the Canadian government needs to provide the people, the native peoples of Canada, with the rights that they're entitled to under Canadian law and under international law.
Gentlemen, thank you both, but time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe, both of you. Mr. Robert Fan, Tina, they're joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Edward Corrigan joining us from London, Ontario. That's a wrap for this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Elsewhere, U.S. media say several of the men involved in the last week assassination of Haiti's president previously worked as U.S. law enforcement informants. Haitian authorities have already announced the arrest of three American citizens. They are among over two dozen people identified in connection with the assassination.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, last Wednesday. No guard was injured in the attack. Officials have not yet explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. They have not said anything about the possible motive behind the assassination either. Haitian police say 28 people were involved in the attack. Three are Haitian Americans who have been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. On Monday, Haitian police said they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used a Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill the president. Washington has said the evidence provided by the Haitian authorities indicates that the assassination plot was at least partly hatched in the United States. Meanwhile, American television CNN said several of the men involved in Moïse's assassination were previously working as U.S. law enforcement informants. CNN cited people briefed on the matter. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration told it that at least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the administration. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. However, the FBI said in response to CNN's reporting that it doesn't comment on informants. A simple history check reveals deep U.S. involvement in Haiti. In 1915, following the assassination of the then Haitian president, the U.S. sent Marines into the tiny island nation. Washington gained complete control over the Haitian finances and the right to intervene there whenever the U.S. government deemed it necessary. This occupation continued until 1934. With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve peace and stability as it goes through this transformation.
Iran's president says the United States abandoned the 2015 nuclear deal under the pressure of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and extremist groups. Rouhani said Tel Aviv, Riyadh, and the anti-Iran bloc have always sought to sabotage Tehran's efforts to deal with the world. The Iranian president said the U.S. withdrawal from the accord was a result of miscalculations of its then-government advisors. Rouhani noted that Washington did not achieve any of its goals by abandoning the agreement. The president also praised the Iranian nation for standing strong in the face of U.S. pressure. The United Arab Emirates has officially opened an embassy in Israel. The Emirati embassy is located in Tel Aviv. The move followed the inauguration of Israel's embassy and consulate in the UAE last month. The measures are the latest steps by the two sides to formalize ties after they reached a normalization agreement in August 2020. Several Arab countries, including the UAE, normalized their relations with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements last year when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. The accord has since been denounced as a betrayal to the Palestinian cause and their efforts to liberate their lands from Israeli occupation. Palestinians called the normalization a stab in their back. Elsewhere, South Korea has tightened its restrictive measures as the country sets a new record for daily COVID-19 cases. The East Asian country reported 1,615 new coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours. It resulted in the imposition of new social distancing measures across the country, with the toughest ones in the greater Seoul area. The restrictions come amid growing concerns over vaccination stagnation and the spread of the more contagious Delta variant. Officials say the new strain accounts for more than 30% of the new coronavirus cases in the country. The total number of cases in South Korea now stands at over 171,000, with over 2,000 total fatalities. Australian authorities extend a coronavirus lockdown in the country's largest city, Sydney, after 3 weeks of restrictions failed to stamp out an outbreak there.
And it always hurts to say this, but we need to extend the lockdown at least a further 2 weeks, from Friday the 16th of July to Friday the 30th of July.
The restrictions were extended after the state of New South Wales identified 97 new locally transmitted cases. The daily caseload represents a slight increase from 89 infections reported a day earlier. Total infections now stand at just under 900 in Sydney, while two deaths have also been reported. The city of 5 million residents was first plunged into a lockdown in late June after a Delta variant outbreak. Since then, many non-essential businesses are closed and people can leave homes only for essential activities. The death toll from 5 days of violence in South Africa has risen to 72 as troops are dispatched to help overstretched police quell the unrest. The violence was set off by last week's imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma. It has now widened into looting and an outpouring of general anger over inequality in the country. Nearly 760 people have so far been arrested. On Monday, the Constitutional Court heard an application to review its decision to jail Zuma for contempt of court. The court has reversed, or rather reserved, its judgment to for later, but since unspecified date. Zuma is sentenced to 15 months in jail for not appearing before a commission looking into graft scandals during his presidency. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moise, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian U.S.-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm over the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Haiti assassination raises red flags among observers fluent in history of U.S. intervention. Stay tuned for more. In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moïse, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian U.S.-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm or the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Recently, the editors of the Miami Herald responded to Moore's murder by asserting that the U.S. must get off the sidelines and act. They wrote, "The U.S. as Haiti's biggest donor has no choice but to take the lead to stabilize Haiti. An international coalition could do immense good very quickly by picking five critical things to focus on, so that basic life in Haiti can continue. Good roads, reliable electricity, clean water, policing that works, and COVID vaccines." The Miami Herald editors were not alone. Robert Fatten, a professor of government affairs at the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, told France 24 that in previous decades, the UN, US, and France have sent troops to Haiti due to political insurgency. If things worsen, I assume we'd have an intervention, unquote. Echoing this sentiment, the editors of Washington Post called for a swift and muscular intervention in Haiti. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said recently at a press conference that the Biden administration is prepared to respond to requests for assistance from Haiti's interim leadership and that the U.S. expects to be in receipt of formal requests for armaments. When asked specifically about the history of U.S. intervention in Haiti and any appetite to intervene again, Price indirectly answered that the United States has an will continue to stand by to provide assistance to the Haitian people. Jake Johnson, a research associate for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, told Maria Abi Habib of New York Times that there will be a lot of calls for international intervention and sending troops in the name of restoring stability to Haiti. But it's important that we take a step back and see how international intervention has contributed to this situation, Johnson said. There's already been billions of dollars spent on so-called nation building in Haiti, which has only contributed to the erosion of the state and politicization of these institutions. To now say we need to do more of this, well, that won't work. Amid reports that at least one U.S. citizen was among those arrested in connection with Moore's assassination and the mounting calls for foreign intervention, the U.S.-based anti-war group Black Alliance for Peace, BAP, said that it smells a rat. What happens now is the question, BAP said in a statement, adding, "Will the Biden administration and other political players use this moment as a pretext for military intervention, as was done in 1915? Whatever happens, the Black Alliance for Peace remains steadfast in our call against foreign intervention and occupation of Haiti," the group said. "And we call on all anti-imperialist and black internationalist forces to stand with the Haitian people and oppose U.S. and European interventions deployed under the guise of the responsibility to protect. For over a century, the U.S. military has helped corporations plunder Haiti, carrying out invasions, supporting coups, and menacing anyone who fights for the freedom and independence of the country, writes artist and activist Rachel Damond. Even if they use humanitarian language, the goal of any U.S. intervention remains the same. Haiti, site of the world's only successful nationwide slave revolt, was the first country in the hemisphere to win its independence after the United States. Over the course of 13 years, beginning in 1791, Haiti's slaves fought to end not only slavery, becoming the first nation to permanently to do so, but also French rule in a colony that, while only the size of Maryland, produced a much wealth as all 13 colonies of the future United States combined. Haiti was the first truly free nation in the Americas and the world's first black republic. Its revolution also belied the hypocritically egalitarian pretensions of the French and U.S. revolutions, the latter which fought to preserve and expand slavery while declaring that all men are created equal. Haiti's revolution, led by Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Toussaint Louverture, Henry Christopher and others, was a tremendous inspiration to enslave black people yearning to be free throughout the hemisphere. It also proved a major catalyst for early U.S. expansion, as it led Napoleon Bonaparte to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States. Thus began the more than 200-year history of U.S. intervention in Haiti. Instead of exalting Haiti's hard-won freedom, the United States refused to recognize the country until 1862. What it did recognize was the crushing debt imposed by France as a condition for peace that continues to harm Haitians to this day. In 1891, U.S. President Benjamin Harrison attempted to acquire a naval base at Mont Saint-Nicolas, prompting Frederick Douglass, the U.S. Minister and Consul General at the time, to declare that there is perhaps no one point upon which the people of Haiti are more sensitive, superstitious, or united than upon any question touching the cession of any part of their territory to any foreign power. Haiti maintained its sovereignty for 116 years until President Woodrow Wilson, who claimed to champion national self-determination, ordered a U.S. invasion in the name of stability following the assassination of Haitian President Jean Wilburn Guillaume Sam. The murder sparked widespread violence, and U.S. Marines wrote time, landed at Port-au-Prince, and began forcibly soothing everybody. The U.S. would occupy Haiti until 1934, killing thousands of Haitians who resisted the invaders. Occupation forces and administrators implemented forced labor in service of building the kinds of infrastructure advocated by the Miami Herald editors, Jim Crow segregation, and looting of the country's finances for the benefit of New York banks. Rape of Haitian women and children by U.S. troops ran rampant and unpunished. Following the withdrawal of U.S. troops, successive administrations in Washington, D.C. supported Haitian dictators, including the brutal kleptocrat François Papadoc Dolivier, not only turning a blind eye to his regime's gross human rights violations, but also training its security forces. Meanwhile, U.S. economic interests profited handsomely from their investments in a stable Haiti, as they claim. Papadoc was succeeded upon his death in 1971 by his son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, who was also backed by the U.S. regime, even as his death squads murdered as many as 60,000 Haitians. Haiti finally held democratic elections in 1990. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a Catholic priest, was elected with two-thirds of the vote. However, less than a year later, he was overthrown in a military coup, whose plotters included CIA operatives. In 1994, Joe Biden, then junior U.S. Senator from Delaware, opined that if Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 600 feet, it wouldn't matter a whole lot to our interest. President Bill Clinton did not agree, and that year his administration secured United Nations Security Council authorization to stage a U.S.-led invasion to restore democracy to Haiti. Clinton sent 25,000 troops on a nation-building mission, and Aristide was returned to the presidency. However, a decade later, the George W. Bush administration actively worked to topple Aristide's government in events culminating in a 2004 coup in which the same CIA-trained forces that previously ousted the president again played a key role. The nation-building exercises that the United States and its international partners have embarked upon in Haiti and around the world have done little to create functioning states, instead creating a system where questionable actors with little national support like Ms. Moore are propped up. The easiest way to achieve short-term stability, writes the Times' Abi Habib. Daniel Larrison, contributing editor at antiwar.com, argues on his website that the U.S. regime needs to break the habit of assuming that political instability somewhere requires military intervention, whether by the U.S. or others. Writer Joseph Sturgeon III adds that Haiti has been struggling against imperialism from the West since the very day she established her sovereignty. It is time that Haiti establish her own destiny, free from intervention from the U.S. regime, from France, from Britain, or any colonial power. She did not carry out a revolution to be under Western control. She carried out her revolution to be free. The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, on the 15th anniversary of the 33-day war, Lebanon's resistance group Hezbollah has released previously unseen footage of the capture of two Israeli soldiers in 2006. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will be discussing the different aspects of this and how it can be considered a turning point. Or let's say turning a new page as far as the axis of resistance is concerned. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Deputy Head of External Affairs in the Syrian Social National Party, Nael Talbi from Beirut, and also Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najim, joining us live from Ottawa. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Now, let's begin with our guest from Beirut, Mr. Kelby, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Now, this footage shows that these events, how they led to the 33-day war. Now, this was the last time that Hezbollah and Israel directly got into an all-out war. Does this footage spell the beginning of the end, in your opinion, of an era where IDF soldiers were considered invincible?
Well, first of all, my name is pronounced Qaed Bey. And as for the footage, actually the beginning of the end could be traced back to 1982, because it is at that time, at that moment in time, that things changed and that the Israeli army stopped being invincible. People from popular classes, people who had no big experience fighting, took up arms and defended their homeland and actually won battles and drove the occupiers away. Of course, after 82, you had the first Intifada, the second Intifada, and so on. And it culminated in 2006, where the occupying force couldn't penetrate to any basically strategic advantage or tactical advantage for that matter.
Now let's bring in our guest from Ottawa, Mr. Firas Al-Najim. Now, in your opinion, why did Hezbollah choose this particular time, the 15th anniversary of the 33-day war, to release this footage?
With regards to TV staff and all viewers, I think it's the battle is growing and is developing to a higher stage now, especially after the recent battle between Gaza, Jerusalem, and all Palestinian cities rising up together against the Zionist regime. They want to show a clear sign, and they want to warn the Zionist regime with the upcoming developments that Hezbollah is a mighty force, Hezbollah is here to stay, and Hezbollah is truly, you know, strong enough to, you know, fight any upcoming battles, and that Israel should take this warning serious and be prepared for a major loss or possibly the liberation of Palestine. Because as we know, like if you listen to Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, in his recent interviews or statements, it's been pretty much saying that he believes that he will be praying in Al-Quds soon, that he really sees this. So, you know, I think the situation in the world also is shaping towards that. You can see the public opinion has been changing, and I think this is part of it. Like, the media has a big role in fighting the injustice and to clarify the truth, you know, from the falsehood. And public opinion is changing. People are now more and more seeing what Israel is about through social media. And, you know, we like, a lot of protests are coming here in Canada and different places, and we see that diverse faces are entering this battle against the Zionist regime. Like, you can see people from every kind of background now. You can see it before, but in a lighter vision. But now it's getting much more bigger and heavier, that people from all kind of, you know, backgrounds, religions, colors, ethnicities, they're standing up against Israel and they're voicing their opinion. And the criticism is growing. You know, Israel worked very hard in their Zionist lobbies and their Zionist media control and influence to, you know, push a certain narrative and to, you know, install fear in people in the world. And I think this media right now showing this video is also going to have some type of shaping in the media to acknowledge the strength of Hezbollah and that they're a legitimate, you know, political party and a legitimate army that's there to protect Lebanon and to liberate Palestine in the future.
And interestingly enough, Mr. Al-Najim, the footage includes a digital simulation of how Hezbollah planned the entire operation. Could you please tell us what you think about that particular part?
I mean, it's to show, you know, that Hezbollah is a complex army. It's a sophisticated army. You know, within its capabilities, limited capabilities and capacities, they are a very strong force. You know, they don't have maybe that many fighters. They don't have as advanced weapons, obviously, as the Zionist regime. Zionist regime is, you know, funded and supported by the majority of the world's powers and countries and systems, and you know what I mean. And they have a lot of advanced weapons. But Hezbollah, within its capacities and capabilities and their experience, are very powerful. And it's you know, it's very clear. Like, this video shows how sophisticated and how well planned they are, and you know, they thought they really were gonna really weaken Hezbollah, especially in the Syrian conflict and battle there. You know, they thought they put them in a quagmire and like have them trapped there, and that they would be weakened. But obviously, they learned more and they became more experienced, and they defeated Daesh and all these terrorist groups, and they now they're a lot more stronger of a force. And this is a big threat to Israel, and they should really take it, you know, serious.
Now back to our guest in Beirut. Now, Hezbollah has on many occasions expressed full readiness to fight with Israel. And recently, let's not forget that Israel's war on Gaza led to a humiliating ceasefire. In your opinion, what does that tell us about the axis of resistance and how strong this has grown ever since?
Well, it's no secret that the occupied people have been getting stronger and stronger. As I said, ever since 1982 and even prior to that, it's been victory after victory, whereas on the military side, Israel has been suffering defeat after defeat. Sadly, we haven't been able to capitulate on the political level, but as my colleague has pointed out, things have been changing on the world scene, and therefore it's getting closer and closer for us to actually capitalize on that change in political scene on the world theater and for us to actually achieve total liberation, in my opinion.
Now, Mr. Al-Najim, how do we see this in with regards to Syria and how the axis of resistance is working there?
Well, you know, Syria has, incurred such, hardships in this last, few years, and they still rose out victorious and patient, and the nation now is reunited as well. And all these terrorist groups that propped up and popped out of, from Syria and from different countries and mercenaries and, world powers supporting them, Hezbollah was able to, their borders secure them as well, Arsal border there, so the terrorists would not come into Lebanon and disrupt Lebanon and destabilize Lebanon. At the same time, they also entered to safeguard, holy shrines and also shrines of or holy places and also historical places such as churches for the Christians and so on, right? So they really shaped the whole region, and Syria was supported by its allies, and it showed that Syria will not be left alone when a battle happens, because a lot of other nations, when I say nations, I mean governments, like illegitimate regimes such as the tribal regimes of Saudi Arabia and all these ones, right? They work and they abandon each other. They supported Saddam, and then when Saddam was, when Iraq was being invaded, they left him behind and just threw him on the side. So this shows that there's a unity between the axis of alliance and also the governments that support the axis of the axis of resistance. That they are one entity and they will not abandon each other. They will stay united and they will support each other through any hardship. And they're willing to sacrifice their lives and anything. Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in one of his speeches, said that I'm willing myself to leave Lebanon and go into Syria and lead this battle myself. And we can see that we're in a very strong position these days, and this is a very dangerous situation for the Zionist regime and these occupiers and settlers. I mean, it's a chance for them right now, I think, to deflect and go back to all these different countries that supported them, I guess, and leave Palestine to be free, because it's going to be liberated. I mean, right now, the Zionist regime, you can see that every border almost has a strong access of resistance. And also inside Palestine, we have an area such as Gaza that's liberated, but it's blockaded. But this this recent battle showed that Gaza is a very, very strong force, and because they're allied with the axis of resistance. And recently, Ismail Haniyeh visited Lebanon, and he sat down with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and all different political factions and resisting groups, and we can see that the unity is growing, and that they will coordinate together in attacks to counter the Zionist regime or to liberate Palestine. I think it's a very strong position. I think this is the way to safeguard human rights, because the human rights violators have no borderline, have no, they don't have a red light. They think they can breach every law. And the main purpose of this, and the reason it was, is because the West has gave them a green light to breach all types of international laws and human rights violations. And, they help them bury these. They help them safeguard them from any punishment, from any sanctions, from any accountability, from war crimes court. You know, they when the International War Crimes Court got involved, the ICC, International Criminal Court, They said it's a kangaroo court. That's what Netanyahu said. They don't respect any accountability or any, you know, anybody that, you know, works for justice. Like, right ahead, they'll disregard them. They will defame them. And this is the work of the Zionist regime. But I think it's coming down to an end very soon.
Well, thank you very much. Now, back to our guests in Beirut. Now, how do you think that the axis of resistance, and Hezbollah in particular, have been able to gain a foothold in the political dynamics of the region? And how have they been able to change these equations?
Well, as you know, the entire geopolitical stance within the region is basically whether you're with occupation or against the occupation. So it's only natural for people who are against the occupation to have a foothold in that dynamic. That being said, whenever you are stronger and whenever you show force, then you would only have a bigger foothold and you would have more to say when the negotiations are gonna happen. And this is why the whole axis of resistance has risen into prominence these past few years, much more so than ever before. I would like to add something to what my colleague said regarding the enclave within Palestine. It's not just Gaza. We can't forget Akka, we can't forget Lid. These are cities within what the Zionist movement considers their inner court. And yet, there were actual battles. Of course, you have an occupying force terrorizing a civilian population, so it's in no way a fair battle. However, you had people revolting against oppression, against occupation, within these lands that the Zionist movement considers their own.
So are you as optimistic as Mr. Al-Najim in the way that media and footage like this are helping shape public opinion regards the axis of resistance?
The media definitely has a big role to play, but I'm more optimistic when I see, you know, things on the ground. When I see Lid, and when I see Akka, and when I see Haifa rising in solidarity with Al-Quds, and again in solidarity with Gaza, this is what makes me optimistic. The media does have a role to play, but it's only minimal when it comes to the engagement on the ground. The engagement on the ground, the results of these engagements over the past 20 years or so, or 30 years even, these results are what make me optimistic, and I think these results will only culminate and the total liberation of Palestine from the sea to the river.
Thank you very much. Mr. Al-Najim, now tell us, how do you believe that the situation has changed since 2006 and that war that proved to be a major failure for the Israeli army? And as far as Hezbollah and its deterrence capabilities are concerned?
Yes, I mean, you know, Israel was known to be the army that can never be defeated, and they're the mightiest army in the region and so on, and they're, you know, they're the strongest, let's just say. But when Hezbollah, with a, you know, a small amount of fighters, dedicated, you know, united, and has a very strong leadership and support by Iran and obviously other allies, it showed that they could defeat the Zionist regime, and they can humiliate the Zionist regime, and they can show how weak they really are. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, they are weaker than the spider web, obviously, okay, the house of the spider. And we've seen that in the battle of 2006. You know, I remember at that time when I was watching the news, the Zionist regime at that time, the leadership, you know, they had their, you know, they had their clashes while the battle was going on. Another thing is that, they were so arrogant, but so foolish at the end of the day. All their decisions they made showed that they're not really capable of having a battle with a really united, strong resistance, you know. And you can see that because they had 3 points that they said that will not be broken, and that this is what we want as a strategy and as a goal. That was that they would pull back Hezbollah. You know, obviously Hezbollah, we have to mention it again, because media has a big role of defaming and manipulating things, calling Hezbollah a terrorist organization, and they call them terrorists all day and brainwashing people. And we know Hezbollah is politically popular, and they've been elected, and they have MPs inside the Parliament of Lebanon. So, I mean, it's absurd when you call them terrorists. The real terrorist entity is obviously Israel, because they're a bunch of mercenaries, and they're still bringing more mercenaries in. But anyways, is that they would pull them back from the Litani River, okay? So they push back Hezbollah. They would destroy their arsenal, their arms and all that, and that they would not negotiate on the prisoner exchange. So they would Hezbollah has to release them unconditionally. Hezbollah said, and Sayyid Hassanullah said, from the beginning of the time when they captured those invaders and those occupiers of Palestine, that they will not negotiate until the release of Samir Kuntar. And that was one of the prisoners that has been in the Israeli regime's prisons for many years. He's not even a Shia. He was, at the time, he was a Durzi, and he was a revolutionary man, a Lebanese man, that wanted to fight and go inside Palestine and try to liberate it. So he went inside and he was captured. But main point is, he said that we will not release until this man is out and certain people. And he was, persistent, he was patient, he was decisive, and he stood for what he stood for in the grounds, and they fought, and endfully, the United Nations had to get involved, they got the UNIFIL to be, in between the border lines, and they couldn't achieve those goals that they put on, on the news and everywhere. So it shows that who was the real winner? Hezbollah. Hezbollah is not a full army. I mean, it's not a full army, and it's not a full government. It's part of a government, and it's a resistance on the border there. So it shows that this small resistance can defeat this mighty army that is supported by most of the world. So truly, Hezbollah
showed... We're running out of time, by the way, Mr. Al-Najim, so...
Sorry, I just want to tell you that Hezbollah showed an example for anybody that wants to resist, that you can win, that this enemy is weak, and they're working on a weak base, and that we can liberate Palestine if we work hard and united together. And I think this is the outcome and the future.
Thank you very much. That was manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najim, joining us live from Ottawa, and also deputy head of external affairs in the Syrian Social National Party, Nael Qaed Bey from Beirut. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight, and thanks for following us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام كان فيما ناجى الله به موسى عليه السلام ما تزين لي المتزينون بمثل الزهد في الدنيا عما بهم الغنى عنه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, in one of his conversations with Prophet Moses, Allah told him the following: those who seek to adorn themselves for me have no better apparel than abstention from the worldly pleasures that they find indispensable.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had some beautiful conversations, and among these conversations, it's interesting, but he was asked by one of his companions about the distinction between backbiting and slander. It's interesting, sometimes we really don't know what the difference is between backbiting and slander. And sometimes we don't even know that there is a difference, if there was one. So Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, after he is asked by his companion about the difference between backbiting and slander, I believe this would be ghibat and tuhmat, the first being backbiting and the second being slander. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, replied, it is an act of backbiting, ghibat, to say concerning your brother what Allah conceals about him. So for example, before we go on to the rest of the conversation, what this means is that there are certain qualities or certain traits which Allah has concealed about a certain person, meaning people in the